You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Onward. I grew up on the Pacific Coast. I'm sure many of you here did. And for me, those Santa Monica waves are really part of my childhood. My father's infantry service in the Pacific War on the island of Luzon is also a part of my heritage. So I was fascinated to read Simon Winchester's biography of the Pacific, that ascendant ocean, as he calls it, that defines our tomorrow in the way the Mediterranean shaped the classical world and the Atlantic connected Europe to the New World. His new book is called Pacific, Silicon Chips and Surfboards, Coral Reefs and Atom Bombs, Brutal Dictators, Fading Empires, and the Coming Collision of the World's Superpowers. There's a lot in that title and in the book. Simon Winchester is one of our great storytellers, and in his new book, we journey with him from Kamchatka to Cape Horn, from Peru to the Philippines, and more. He blends history, geography, natural science, and the keen observation that marks all of his work as an investigative reporter and author. His penchant for exploration manifested early in his life during studies at Oxford, when he joined the University Exploration Club and was the member of a six-man sledding expedition onto an uncharted section of the East Greenland ice cap in 1965. It's really worth reading the bio on his website. It's been quite a life. You may know his writing from his many best-selling books, including The Professor and the Madman, The Map That Changed the World, Atlantic, Krakatoa, and The Man Who Loved China. In 2006, Queen Elizabeth made him an officer of the Order of the British Empire. And tonight, Simon is joined by author Tom Lutz, another inveterate traveler who, when he's not teaching at UC Riverside English Department, where he zoomed in from tonight, or working fiendish hours on behalf of the Los Angeles Review of Books, of which he is founder and publisher, he himself is often off on travels to far-flung parts of the world like Belarus, Swaziland, and Transnistria, just to name a few. Tom is also the author of several acclaimed books, including Crying, American Nervousness, and Doing Nothing, A History of Loafers, Loungers, Slackers, and Bums in America. And I'm proud to say that when Tom came to Aloud to talk about the Slacker book in 2006, we put a couch on the stage, and his son Cody napped through the entire program. As the poet Lou Welch wrote, quote, "I like playing that game, standing on a high rock, looking way out over it all, saying, I think I'll call it the Pacific." So onwards to that great ocean. Please welcome Simon Winchester and Tom Lutz.
Hello, all. Thanks for coming. I thought I would start, Simon, by asking you, the last time we saw each other, it was when the Atlantic book had just come out. And so when I first saw this, I thought maybe you were cheating on that other ocean, and I felt bad about it. But really, the Pacific has been your subject in a number of books. I mean, the West Coast of the Americas book, Krakatoa, Korea. How did that get started? I think it started in the Pacific.
I think it's because I lived in Hong Kong for a long time, and I actually drove to Hong Kong from London. I drove to India. I went by train, that's right, from platform 2 Liverpool Street to platform 9 Kowloon, which is a great train journey to take. And from then on, for the next 13 years, I lived beside the Pacific. And editors in those days, the 80s and early 90s, spent money like drunken sailors, and so they would send me all over the ocean. And thanks to them, and this was The Guardian, and Condé Nast Traveler, which was a magazine which began in 1987, shortly after I got to Hong Kong, I just went everywhere and became fascinated with this enormous body of water, and was in the uniquely privileged position of managing to go all around it, I mean, to the most bizarre and extraordinary places. So
I was asking earlier whether it was still possible to go around by tramp steamer, which is what I read about as a boy, and I've been wanting to go on a tramp steamer for the last 60 years or so. I haven't managed it yet, but
well, it
I take
is,
it you have.
It is possible. No, I've never done it, but oddly enough, that is a slightly complicated story, but I had a contract from Henry Holt, the publishers, to write a book about tramp steamers once, because tramp steamers essentially have disappeared from the world, except in the Pacific, as it happens. Most of the world's tramp steamers, and you define a tramp, they're normally small. They're about 800 tons, so maybe 100 feet long, and with a couple of cranes, with a one hold, maybe two, and maybe they're container-friendly. They can carry a couple of containers. And the definition of a tramp is it's a sort of sea gypsy. It goes with a cargo from, let's say, A to B, and then when it gets to B, it hustles for another cargo, which may take it back to A, or it may go on to C, may then go to D. And we thought it would be a very nice idea, and to write a sort of hymn to a dying way of maritime life, to buy a steamer. And there are lots of them laid up in the Baltic, and relatively inexpensive. You can buy one for about £200,000, I think, $350,000. So I had this idea that I would buy one, and I couldn't drive it because I'm colorblind and couldn't get into the Royal Navy as a result of that, and that was my initial ambition in life. But I could get friends of mine who would crew it, and it would be, they'd be sort of the caricatures of you know, the dyspeptic chief engineer and the melancholic radio operator and the wild, perpetually drunken captain. And unfortunately, it tended to be lissome young beauties who would say, "Oh, can I cook?" But not in the, you know, not in the Baltic or not in the Bay of Biscay, but in the South Pacific in the summertime. And anyway, I had this plan to do this book, and I had a contract, and I knew the ship I was going to buy. But then, like a shot across the bows, came this idea, which turned into The Professor and the Madman, a book about 19th century lexicography. So I cancelled the contract and never did it. But the research I did, and this is goes to your point, there is a company in Australia called Burns Phillip, which operates tramp steamers in the Pacific Islands. So you can go from the Cook Islands to Tokelau to Samoa on a tramp steamer.
And I can rent a room on one of them.
You can rent a room on it.
Sorry, I have to go now.
I don't blame you. It's a wonderful way of life. Mm. And it's a great book waiting to be written.
And now I had a friend who crossed the Pacific on a sailboat with his wife. And when they got back, she wept and made him promise that he would never make her do that again. that she just found the kind of long, long days of nothing but ocean very disturbing. But you clearly enjoy them.
Well, I did. I mean, I have never sailed across the Pacific in one. I've sailed across the Indian Ocean, and that is miserable when you get into the doldrums. I mean, because if you're sailing and you don't have a motor, and we didn't have a motor, you are just stuck there, like Captain Bligh, just waiting. If you had 20 men, you could get into a rowboat and pull the boat along until the first breath of wind. We had none of that, and so we were marooned for 2 or 3 weeks, I think, waiting, and that gets really boring, especially if your food's running out and the water's running out. It actually gets quite dangerous. So I can imagine she wept, but at the same time, it's like when I lived in India, people would say, India, difficult country, when you arrive, you cry, and when you leave, you cry again. Mm-hmm. I would say, I think it's probably the same for the Pacific. I bet she cries now, missing the Pacific, it. Yeah.
Well, I assume that everybody that's here tonight has this little bit of a dream that I have, which is the image of the South Sea Island is one of our images of paradise. One of the interesting things about your book is that you talk about the dark side of that image. Do you want to talk about?
Yes. Well, there's one story which doesn't appear in the book, which is it's dark, but in a literal sense, and it also came with a remarkable surprise. We were doing a series of pieces on, it was the 1999-2000 time change, and I wanted to write a piece about the first man in the world to wake up. And so we reasoned that the first man, or the first person, I should say, wake up would be on living on a Pacific island closest to the international date line.
Right.
And that island, it's a little island in the Tonga group. It's a tiny little place called Tafahi. And it's a little sort of pyramid-shaped island, the place where Ben Carson would have grain being stored. And it's actually, I shouldn't have said that, I'm sorry, I'm aware that, as I'm sure you all are, that the debate is going on as we speak. But it's well known for vanilla. It's one of the, produces the choicest vanilla, they claim, in the world. And it's about 5 miles from the dateline.
Mm-hmm.
And you can actually stand on the summit and look at Savai, which is the westernmost island in western Samoa, and that's on the other side of the dateline. So you can look into yesterday. It's just an interesting thing to be able to do. So I was there with a photographer. It's a very difficult island to get to. And we wanted to go to the most easterly village, in other words, the first place in the world to get the first rays of the morning sun. And we imagined it would be a big strapping Tongan, because the Tongans are gigantic people. And this would be an emblematic photograph, and the photographer was very much looking forward. Slightly hampered by the fact that it was sheeting down with rain during the night. It was muddy, it was cold, it was miserable. We stumbled through the dark on this island, which is very not supplied with roads and things like that. It was completely dark. But we made our way to, you could just about see a clutch of huts. And the most easterly hut in the most easterly village was it. So we stood there in the rain, as much shelter as we could find, listening. There were sort of pigs snuffling around in the mud, and you could hear the thunder of the surf down below. And then at about 5:30 in the morning, a vague lightening in the eastern sky, but grey. There was no sort of spectacular sunrise. So this story wasn't going to be quite as pictorial as I imagined it to be. So then there was a match lit, and a Coleman lantern or something like that went on inside the hut, and we thought, great, the day is beginning. And what I wanted to hear was the sound of a grass skirt put on and a pandanus leaf belt tied, because that's what all the Tongans in these remote islands wear. But I was slightly dismayed when I heard a zip fastener being pulled. I thought, oh dear, well, this man is obviously very much part of the 20th or soon to be 21st century, but I can live with that. And then the door opened, so there was a little shaft of light, and a man stepped out, and he wasn't a large, you know, rugby-playing type, Tongan type. He was a rather smaller person, so I thought this wasn't quite what I expected. But what I didn't expect was what he said when he saw the shadows of the two of us. He said, "Gruscott." And I said, I beg your pardon, which is not a Tongan greeting. And he said, "Oh, I'm on holiday. I'm working for Volkswagen in Germany." And so we took his photograph, but we realized that the world was the world it was because the first people in the world to wake up was a German. So that sort of surprise litters the Pacific.
I am surprised that didn't make the cut.
Well, I've forgotten about it.
But I asked the question about the dark side because of the bikini H-bomb tests and the kind of continued devastation of the islands.
Yes, I mean that's obviously the much more serious, and that was frivolous.
And you start the book with your first major chapter is about those islands.
Yes, and it angers me more now that I'm talking about it than when I was writing about it, I think, because the ruin and the misery that we Americans, and I'm an American now, so I incorporate myself into the guilt, is quite extraordinary. And the cynicism with which, for instance, we persuaded the Bikinians to leave the island. Bikini Atoll is in the Marshall Islands, and it's a pretty large lagoon with about 50 or so islands, some small, some quite large, of which one is Bikini, and all the others have other different Marshallese names. And they have a very small population. I think about 170 people were living there when the Americans decided that this would be the ideal place to test both the fission bombs and then later on the fusion, the big hydrogen bombs. And so the people in the Pentagon decided on Bikini and then decided they had to move the people. But how to do it? Well, they stumbled across the fact that the Bikinians were all Christians, because the Christian missionaries, another interfering gang in my view, had come across in the 19th century and had converted them all to Christianity and had forced them to do things like, you know, wear clothes, although extremely unattractive Mother Hubbard, you know, muumuu type dresses, so they looked pretty ridiculous. And there's this rather sad film you see, you can see it on YouTube, of these islanders gathered around a young sailor from the Pentagon who's come to give the message or ask for permission to use their island to test these weapons. And he says, they've just left their daily routines of mending their nets or taking their outriggers out or climbing the coconut trees to get coconuts or tending to their gardens, doing perfectly peaceful, quotidian things. And he's saying to them, you remember from your Christian teachings how the Israelites were led out of the Holy Land behind a pillar of fire. Well, that symbol, a pillar of fire, we can create a pillar of fire and in fact intend to do so on this island. So what we are doing is God's work for the good of mankind. And so will you allow us to use this symbol of a pillar of fire to suggest that you leave your islands too, just as the Israelites left? And the islanders said, yes, if you're doing God's work, then this does seem symbolic, and we will leave. And so they left, and then the Americans started the testing and blew the island to smithereens and utterly irradiated it. And the islanders were transported to a miserable, wretched little island in the very south of the Marshalls, with no lagoon, no palm trees, no abilities to go fishing. And they just have to have air-dropped food to them and come up with some sort of a way of life, which is totally different from the way that they had enjoyed in Bikini. And by extraordinary coincidence, the foreign minister of the Marshall Islands is in London this week, as we speak, asking the British government if we might take these people in. And this is half a century or more since they were displaced from their home, because thanks to rising sea levels, the island to which they have been exiled is now flooding. So they've had a double dose of misery, being exiled from their homes by radiation and by pillar of fire, and by being flooded out of their new homes for another reason that mankind has conspired to create, the warming of the seas and the rising of the sea levels. So it seems that injustice has been rained down to them in spades and by Westerners, who if they'd never come and just left them to their business, would have, I think, respected a way of life that they have utterly disrespected.
Yeah, and I should say that the book is organized as a series of chapters on different topics over the last 60 years. And it 60?
So, yes, since years, 1950. So
1950. And they're on very, very different subjects. This Bikini Atoll is one. But the other is what you call the most sublime gift that the South Seas ever gave to playtime.
Yes.
Right?
And that's surfing.
Right.
It sounds frivolous and trivial, but I actually think it's not really. And I think the story is, I think it's fascinating. I mean, surfing or the wave riding, as it's called in Polynesian languages, the putting a board on top of the waves and standing up on it and allowing the waves to carry you into shore, was essentially part of the culture of in Tahiti, the Society Islands, for a long, long time, until the Hawaiians got wind of it in the 19th century and then developed it into quite a sport with rules, and the Hawaiian aristocracy used certain beaches and the common people used other beaches. And then the missionaries once again came and saw to their great distress that the Hawaiians like to surf naked. Seems to be an entirely reasonable thing, but apparently the women just, missionary ladies said, were shocked, seeing these huge naked men roaring in, and said, you've either got to wear muumuus to surf or stop surfing. And the Hawaiians quite reasonably said, well, we're not going to surf wearing muumuus, thank you very much. And so we'll stop surfing. And effectively, they did. And surfing died in the latter half of the 19th century, except for the children. Children, the adults used gigantic boards, 20, 22 feet long, I mean, three times as long as a man. Children used much smaller boards called pupau. And Jack London happened to be in Hawaii in 1907 on the Snark, proceeding across the Pacific. And he and his wife went swimming off the, and it was then a village, the village of Waikiki. Mm. And suddenly, when he was out sort of languishing in the 100 feet from shore or so, suddenly he was surrounded by hundreds of these adorable little children all racing in on these surfboards. And he thought, what is this? This looks wonderful fun. And he got them and other people to teach him. And he was a big lumbering white man and thought he would never learn to be as graceful as they. But in fact, he did. And he said the moment that he got on top of a wave and rowed successfully to shore was just one of the most sublime moments in his life. So he wrote an essay full of enthusiasm and joy about this discovery in the October 1907 edition of the Women's Home Companion, not the obvious choice for her, but Surfing the King of Sports. And this piece was syndicated in the Pall Mall Gazette in London and in a magazine in Australia. And as a consequence of that, surfing took hold in certain places near here, Redondo Beach, for instance, mm-hmm. and Malibu and Bondi Beach in Australia. But it became restricted, or initially it was restricted to the Pacific Rim, as it were, until, and it's the date that I begin this chapter on, and that's 1959, which is when there was released in the suburbs of New York, and specifically in Long Island, a movie that Columbia Pictures didn't have very much confidence about. But it was the movie Gidget. And the New York Times raved about this film, about this little 15-year-old girl, Kathy Kona, because it was a story written by Kathy's father about his daughter and learning to surf. And this suddenly rendered the sport a worldwide phenomenon. And it's now, what, $13 billion a year? And it infects all sorts of unexpected aspects of society. I mean, management, for instance. I mean, the Patagonia company, for instance, the man who started it, Yvon Chouinard, said, people that surf are happy. So why don't I put my factories that make all this sports clothing on the beach, effectively, and if the surf's up, let my people go surfing. And then when they come back, whenever they want to, they work much harder than if they've been chained to a desk all day. And so the whole idea of sort of flexi-time, which now is, of course, Google and Facebook and everyone does it, really had its birth with the surfing industry. But the lovely coda from my personal point of view is that, I mean, I wrote quite a lot about Gidget, and last week Gidget wrote to me. She's Kathy Zimmerman now, and she's 70 years old. She still surfs every day. She lives in Malibu, and she works 2 days a week in a bookstore. And she found this book and apparently was very pleased. And anyway, we're having lunch next week. So I'm having lunch with Gidget. I could not be happier.
Yeah, for the second edition.
Maybe, yes. Lunch goes well.
In another chapter, you talk about a discovery of some thermal things going on, made with a small submersible, kind of famous small submersible, that some scientists say rivals Columbus's discovery of the Americas.
Yes, I mean, it's always been said, and I think this was also something I discovered when I was doing the book about the Atlantic, that people say that, I mean, cartographers say now that we know the surface of the moon and the surface of Mars at a resolution of, you know, each meter we know. But the surface of the Earth, where it's covered by water, we know less than every kilometer. We know it's such an alien world down there. And so Alvin, which is this submersible, three-man submersible, which is owned by the Navy but operated by Woods Hole in Massachusetts, has been doing this heroic job of undersea exploration and discovered in the Pacific, first of all, the hydrothermal vents off the Galapagos Islands, and then the black smokers and the white smokers. And I suppose there were two discoveries of
great significance. I mean, that they exist is phenomenal and remarkable in and of itself, but that they're living creatures down there, miles down, pitch dark, bitterly cold, no apparent nutrients, and yet there's life. There are these enormous clams, and there are these, the most interesting things are these tube worms. You get these sort of forests of worms which move back and forth in the tides. And how did they live? Because there's no photosynthesis down there, because there's no light. And it was this young woman called Colleen Cavanaugh who discovered and blurted it out in a classroom and was told to be quiet, couldn't contain your enthusiasm, that it was all due to chemical reactions with sulfur, that the sulfur combined with the oxygen in the seawater to give energy and sugar and all these good things, and that life can be created in a mix which requires no light at all. So it's chemosynthesis rather than photosynthesis. And so it's taught us a great deal about the origins of life as well. So, I mean, that's one reason why these black smokers and the hydrothermal vents are fascinating. But the other thing is that these black smokers particularly are great towers of minerals. And as a consequence of that, Alvin and other submersibles discovered that there are these fields of heavy metal sulfides dotted around the Pacific. And, it would be nice to think that humankind would leave them alone, but they're not. Mm. And so there are two fields in particular, one off Papua New Guinea and one off Tonga, where an Australian company has got the necessary licenses and is building gigantic machines, I mean, really science fiction type machines, in a dockyard, a former shipyard in Newcastle upon Tyne in England, and bringing these machines with hand blades and tracks and grabbing arms and things. And they're just going to lower them on cables down onto the hitherto pristine seabed and completely careless of what fish or wildlife they might harm. They're just going to chew up the seabed and claw these minerals. And a huge thing that looks like an elephant's trunk is going to be lowered 2 miles down onto the seabed and suck all this material up onto barges. And it'll be taken off to be smelted in China. And it just seems to me another example of mankind's unwanted interference with the Pacific. I just wish they'd leave it alone. But we seem to need the copper sulfide and the zinc sulfide and all the other sulfides to make our lives somehow better. We don't care about the sea.
Unless it can do things for us.
Indeed.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to ask you my academic geeky question.
I was a bit worried about this. You warned me that there was a nerdy question.
I did warn you that there was a nerdy question. It's that in roughly around 1980, a French philosopher named François Lyotard wrote a book called The Postmodern Condition. And in that book, he said that we can no longer tell the grand narratives. This history of progress, the history of mankind. These are ideological, and they're no longer respectable history. What we should be doing, he said, is telling les petits récits, the little stories, the anecdotes. And it seemed to me that this book is doing that in a way. It's saying, in order to tell the history of the Pacific, the way to do it is to find the local stories, the story of Bikini, the story of Tonga, the story of the thermals, and tell that story and tell a series of them rather than a kind of sweeping narrative history. Does that ring any bells with...
Well, it does ring bells because there is this movement hatched by and supported by Bill Gates at the moment, the Big History Project, which is a chap down in, is it Macquarie University, I think, in Melbourne? He's an Englishman who now teaches big history. Completely the opposite of this Frenchman. He says, I'm going to start with the Big Bang and bring it down to Agincourt or something like that. And he does. I mean, it's a tour de force when you're getting into the French vernacular tonight. So it's a wonderful thing to see him doing this. David, I forget his last name, but anyway, he does it wonderfully. My thought was that, no, I would not try and write the big history of the Pacific because I wanted to look at it as the ocean of the future, and I wanted to start it in relatively modern times and wanted, therefore, not to write about Balboa and Magellan and Captain Cook and people like that. And the question was, first of all, when to begin the story. And so the initial date I thought of would be the 2nd of September 1945, which was the Japanese surrender, which seemed to be a good, the end of the war, the beginning of a new era for the Pacific, or one of the great sort of hinge points of modern history, which would be the 10th of October 1949, which was the founding of the People's Republic of China, which struck me as very important. But then I happened upon this third date, which, may I explain it? Or,
yes, please.
Because
yes.
Which is the 1st of January 1950. And the reason for that goes to the counting system that we use for dating things, I mean, like BC and AD that we use today, before Christ and Anno Domini, is non-relevant to non-Christians and is offensive to some people. So there was this fudge created of BCE, which for people with an affection for Christianity is before Christian era, or those more secularly minded, before common era. And that's sort of okay, but it didn't really satisfy the scientific community. And they came up 20 or 30 years ago with the concept of BP, which is before present. You talk about the Wisconsin Ice Age having occurred 10,000 years BP. Before present is fine, but it does prompt the question, well, when is present?
Mm-hmm.
And they decided...
It could be
a moving target, but they would settle on a certain date. So the index here for present is the 1st of January 1950. And the reason for that, it was settled by a group of radiochemists at Queen's University Belfast, who said that before 1950, carbon-14 dating was accurate. We knew the ratio of stable carbon-12 to unstable carbon-14. That was fixed. It was about a trillion to one. But after 1950, because of nuclear testing, one of the byproducts of weapons testing is carbon-14. And so lots more was being pumped into the upper atmosphere. And all of a sudden, carbon-14 dating was inaccurate. You had to introduce an algorithm each year to make it work. So for, 13 years, atmospheric testing effectively ended, except, of course, for the French in 1963. Everything was distorted. And so the BP people said, well, okay, 1st of January 1950, before that date, The world was pure. And after that date, the world was impure. And from my point of view, since the impurities were thrown up, nearly all of them, from the Pacific Ocean, it seemed a very suitable date for me to begin the book. So then the way I tried to tell it was as the Frenchman suggested I should, which is in a series of sort of pointillist portraits, selecting, I made a list of, I think, 200 or 300 events that occurred.
I was wondering,
in the Pacific. Went through newspapers and archives and all sorts of things, and then winnowed them down to 10, because I thought 10 chapters was a reasonable number of chapters, hoping that the 10 I've chosen, and it's up to the critics to decide whether I've chosen them wisely or randomly.
I'm a critic, so I'm saying...
Oh, well, great. Well, so you're putting thumbs up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Two thumbs up. Well, good. Thank you very much, because... I mean, certainly the Wall Street Journal didn't like it at all. You thought I was anti-American. I don't get that. I'm simply saying I'm not anti-American. I just wish the West had taken better care of the ocean. But I think each of the 10 things that I've chosen, what I hoped was that each one would sort of betoken a trend, which would together would paint a portrait of what the Pacific is like now and what I think it'll develop into in the future. So it's a bit of both, a big history and a lot of little history.
And of course, you might be accused of being anti-Japanese or anti-Chinese or anti. Right? I mean, it's not just the Americans that.
No, I mean the Canadians are very cross because I hardly wrote about Canada. But where's Canada?
Yeah.
Good question.
The Spratly Islands. You talked about the ocean as the ocean of the future. Part of that future is wrapped up in a string of islands off the coast of China. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yes, I mean, I think this is absolutely fascinating. And it all goes back to talk about unintended consequences. When I was living in Hong Kong, I used to go to the Philippines a lot because we were watching the fall of President Marcos. Mm-hmm. So after Marcos left in the late 1980s, the next big story was the eruption of an enormous volcano, Mount Pinatubo. And I had covered Mount St. Helens here, so I was interested in volcanoes, and this was a big one. And I might say parenthetically that I got into awful trouble after the volcano blew its top, and there was a crater lake. I went out there with a photographer to take some pictures of the ruin, and we went in a helicopter from Manila, and we took two kayaks with us, and because we thought it'd be amusing to paddle around in the crater lake. And so I get out onto the boat, onto the lake with Rob Howard, who's called the photographer, taking photographs, and I go towards the center of the crater lake where there's still bubbling coming up from underneath. And what stupidly I didn't realize is that the water above the bubbles is incredibly hot, and the canoe started melting, and the two ends of it, rather like in that Mr. Hulot's Holiday. So I paddled back to shore, but then it didn't unmelt, and I had to take this distorted sort of banana shape back. However, the important consequence of that volcanic eruption was that it dumped huge amounts of volcanic ash on two very important American military bases, mm-hmm. Subic Bay Naval Base and Clark Air Base. And Dick Cheney, the Secretary of Defense at the time, decided that the destruction of the bases was so comprehensive that they had to be closed down. Mm. So all of a sudden, all the ships that used Subic Bay and all the aircraft that used Clark were taken back to Guam or bases in Japan, further east in the Pacific. Well, a military vacuum was in consequence created in the South China Sea. There was no one there, no superintendents of American warships. Well, who, of course, filled that vacuum only too happily, and that was the Chinese. So, but this was all part of a stratagem devised at about the same time, as it happens, by this remarkable man. He's now dead. He died at 93, about 3 years ago, called Liu Huaqing. And Liu Huaqing he's a PLA general, and actually he was the general in charge of the troops at Tiananmen Square on the 4th of June 1989. But he was also in the Navy. I mean, it's a weird thing about the organization of the PLA, that the Navy is PLA brackets N for Navy. So as well as being a general in the army, he's also an admiral in the Chinese Navy and a brilliant naval strategist. And it was always part of his plan to expand into the South China Sea, but also, as I'll explain in a moment, also beyond into the open waters of the Blue Pacific. So what they did almost immediately, as soon as the American ships and warplanes had left Subic and Clark, they decided that they would occupy some of the most useful to them of the hundreds of little islands, coral reefs and barely submerged islets in the Spratly Islands and the Paracels, which are in the South China Sea. And they did it in a very sort of, I know cunning is a slightly loaded word, but in a very stealthy way. They would, you know, put up a lighthouse on this island, or they'd build a little runway on that one. And doing it piecemeal like this, it would have been gross overreaction for the Americans to say, you can't do this and sail an aircraft carrier in. It would seem, you know, bullying. So the Americans did nothing, and they turned a blind eye. I think they were actually ignorant of what was going on. And then 5 years ago, the Pentagon woke up to the idea, the realization that the South China Sea was now peppered with Chinese military bases, the little ships in this island, the little aircraft here, capital city there, radio station here, radars there. It was an amazing forward base, if you liked, for Chinese operations. So that was one thing that happened. But then the second part of Admiral Liu's grand strategy was for the Pacific, was to create three sort of imagined bastions of protective islands in the Pacific, further and further out from the shore of, sort of China. So that what's called the first island chain is a chain of islands running from Japan to Indonesia, sort of relatively close to the Chinese coast. And then the second island chain, further out, would run from Kamchatka in Russia down to Cape York in Australia. And then the third island chain, further out still, in the middle of the Pacific, would go from the Aleutian Islands to Hawaii down to New Zealand. And the strategy is that by 2049, which is the 100th anniversary of the founding of the PRC, China will be able to exercise all the way out to the third island chain. So they're now, if you go to the first island chain, you will see Chinese warships all over the place, including their newly modernized ex-Russian aircraft carrier, the Liaoning. They've got three, maybe even four, aircraft carriers on order, and they build them very quickly. And the thought is that by 2020, they'll be operating in the second island chain, in other words, going to places like Tonga and so forth, and Coral Sea. And by 2049, they'll be exercising carrier battle groups off Pearl Harbor. And this makes the American admirals very nervous, because they have long regarded in the Pentagon the Pacific to be an American lake, if you like. They will point to, they'll show you pictures. Entirely, I'm not critical if I say this. They'll show you a picture of, look at Seoul in 1945, look at Seoul today. Look at Shanghai in 1948, look at Shanghai today. That prosperity has been won because American steel has protected the shipping lanes. Mm-hmm. And so, thank heavens that the Americans run the Pacific, because the Pacific is a very prosperous place. And the Chinese say, well, that may be so. We have no territorial ambitions. We just think it is perfectly right and proper that we have marine equivalents and that we can operate our ships. We're not going to threaten you. But of course, the Americans, the hawks in the Pentagon, think it is a threat. And so we get patrols like the destroyer, the Lassen, which was sailing, in my view, rather provocatively close to these new Chinese islands the other day, and the Chinese getting rather annoyed about it. Mm-hmm. So it's a tricky situation.
It's a tricky situation, and there's a lot of things to worry about, including the kind of permanent El Nino. And since we're all worried about the coming El Nino, I'm sure there'll be a question perhaps about that. I thought maybe before we turn it over to the audience for questions, so that I could ask you to read one page. It's on page 265. Starting with the first paragraph. I've got it here if it makes it easier.
Well, okay, if it does. So the first paragraph on the right-hand page or the left?
On the left-hand page, yeah.
That's the right-hand page.
Or the second sentence of that paragraph, actually. It's because there's so much bad news in the book, this is a very kind of uplifting passage. I thought it might help.
Yes, except, well, I'm sure we'll talk about it later, but I love the whole thing about the Hokulea and Polynesian long-distance navigation, which is very cheering. I mean,
yes, it is.
There's a lot of good stuff in the book as well.
And Gidget.
Yeah. So we're talking, just to put this in context, about how the Pacific is really the weather generator for the world, and that there's this big research outfit in Tokyo called Jamstack, which has this massive supercomputer called the Earth Simulator 2, which comes up with forecasts every 6 seconds for the whole planet. And there's incontrovertible evidence now that the Walker circulation and the El Nino and all these various things drive the weather everywhere, not just in California, but in Europe and in Africa as well. So I talk about how more intense and frequent El Niños will cause more frequent typhoons and hurricanes and lots of mayhem. But I think there's the cheerful bit is at the end.
Yes, right.
So locally, there will be mayhem, but globally, less so. The planet perhaps will manage to heal itself. This is because the Pacific is an enormous heat sink. It absorbs an awful lot of the heat from the sun. The world and its creatures will survive, and all will eventually allow itself to come back into balance, just as the geologic record shows that it survived and returned to balance after any number of previous cycles of excess and danger. Once that happens, the Pacific Ocean will be seen uniquely for what many climatologists are coming to believe it to be, a gigantic safety valve essential to the future of the planet. The ocean's monstrous size puts it in a position to let the planet go thermally wild for a time, to wobble dangerously. But then, like a formidable gyroscope, the Pacific will dampen the excess, will help bring sanity back, and will restore calm, serenity, and normality. The Pacific Ocean is the world's pacifier. The thought is maybe born of all too little science, but it is a thought endowed with poetry and is now held by many. And in the gloom-dimmed world of today, even such a thought is surely a most welcome one.
Thank you so much. It's a wonderful book. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. It's a wide-ranging, and obviously you're a fantastic storyteller. And if you haven't read it yet, you should. And if you have read it, or even if you haven't, it's time for you to ask us some questions. And there are microphones if you would like to. And I think that I'm not calling on people, right?
I was in Hiroshima 2 weeks ago, and I was wondering what happened there in the 40s, how that would affect the 1950 date and carbon dating.
Oh, well, those bombs, and this is one of the terrible realities of the nuclear arrangements of today, were tiny. They were really small. And so their contribution to... and the contribution of the early testing was minimal. It really wasn't until the thermonuclear weapons started being developed in the early 1950s that this thing really, really took off. Yes, there was a contribution to the carbon-14 burden, but it was relatively, relatively small. It is a terrible thought that the biggest of all the bombs that the Americans exploded was on March the 1st, 1954, in Bikini. It was known as the Castle Bravo experiment. And that was 50 megatons. They thought it was going to be 17, but they made an oops miscalculation. And when you consider that the Hiroshima bomb and the Nagasaki bomb were both about 25 kilotons, relatively small, I mean, the amount of destruction that can be wrought by the kind of thermonuclear weapon, of which, what, there are 15 or so in every warhead of every submarine-launched missile today is just terrifying. And the awful thing about that particular bomb, Castle Bravo, is that it was detonated by a man who had survived a nuclear accident at Los Alamos. He was called Alvin Graves. And he nearly died, but he didn't die. And so his attitude towards radiation is... it's just for sissies. Radiation, if you're a big, strong man like me, Alvin Graves, you can survive. He was put in charge of the big explosion in 1954, and the wind on the days before the detonation were blowing to the northwest, where the fallout would have affected nobody. But 2 days before the detonation, the wind back to the east, such that it would be blowing over two very inhabited islands called Rongelap and Rongerik. And everyone pleaded with him not to conduct the test because they said these people are going to be irradiated. And he said, radiation's no big deal. I survived it. I'm strong. They'll survive it. They'll get over it. And so he ordered the button to be pressed. And the people were ruined by it, utterly irradiated. The calcined coral came down. They thought it was snow. They were licking it and tasting it. They all became very sick. And the Americans, for 2 or 3 days, wouldn't move them off the islands because they thought, this is great. We've got people that we can use as guinea pigs to see how bad the radiation is. In the end, they moved them, but they suffered grievously, and all because of one stupid man being macho about it.
Can you discuss the section in the book on Silicon Valley or the computer chips?
Yes, what I do is actually I talk less about modern semiconductors and more about the invention of the transistor radio, which I thought was a very important. It started something, a pattern of trade, which has never ceased since. And it was in 1955 when this little shirt pocket-sized radio set appeared in the shops in, oddly enough,
Edmonton and Winnipeg and Vancouver in Canada, and then later, about 2 months later, in New York. And this was a radio set which, I mean, up to that point, radios had been pieces of furniture, I mean, covered with walnut, and you put the aspidistra on top and you turn them on and they warmed up. And this you could take to the beach or take it to bed or take it to class or wherever and listen to your programs. It transformed people's lives in an interesting, subtle but interesting way. But what it also did was this device was made, the manufacturer's name was written on top of the dial, Tokyo Telecommunications Company, but underneath in tiny letters was this new, unfamiliar word, the word Sony. It was the first Sony device. It was made by this man, Masaru Ibuka, who had been in at Bell Labs in New Jersey and had worked, had bought the license to produce transistors, which had been invented in New Jersey, over to Japan, and started creating these things. The TR-55 was the first, and then he made them ever more sophisticated. And he was an extraordinary man. I mean, if we think of Sony at all, I guess we tend to think of that rather smooth, sort of silver-haired man, Akio Morita, who was the sort of public face of Sony. But Ibuka was a rough and tough engineer, and a man who invented all sorts of things. He invented the Walkman, and he invented the Trinitron television. He invented the Betamax. But so happened that the transistor radio was invented almost exactly the same time as the shipping container was invented. And the two essentially were put together. And within months, products made by Sony and other new Japanese companies, Panasonic and so forth, started coming over in this relentless west-to-east trade pattern, which has never let up. I mean, it's moved away from Japan now. First of all, it was Korea and companies like Samsung, and then to where it is now, China. But every time you see a fully laden container ship sliding under the Golden Gate Bridge towards the docks in Oakland, you should remember, I think, that that all started with one little radio set in a shop in Edmonton, Alberta in 1955. So that's how I tell this. I mean, it ends up talking about Apple and Microsoft, but its beginning, I think, was with this one iconic moment in 1955.
Do you consider this book to be a prequel or sequel to any sort of cultural works that are already out?
Any cultural works that have... I'm not sure that I understand.
Was there ever a book that you read and you thought this book would be sort of a nice companion piece, or was there a film that you saw somewhere along the way that you thought like this could sit well with it sort of on a shelf?
No, except, I mean, there's the famous book about the Mediterranean by, is it Jacques Bazin? I can't remember. There's the Mediterranean, the Age of Philip II is all right. A classic book on an ocean. And it's not Jacques Bazin, it's someone else and his name... Ferdinand Brodel, exactly. And so I think that's in a way what inspired me to do the book on the Atlantic, which came out 5 or 6 years ago, and then this book on the Pacific. I'm not going to write a book about the Indian Ocean because I know what I'm going to do next, which is nothing to do with oceans at all. But I think, yes, the inspiration came from Brodel's book, which is a majestic. It's a difficult read, but it's a very worthwhile read.
You seem to have an extraordinary memory. Do you have any tips?
I know I, you know, it's funny. I have a decent memory, but I think it's a bit of a curse because I think I'll be incredibly sensitive to knowing when I'm losing it. And that I worry about. I mean, I always remember the telephone number that I dialed from the bath in 1998 that started me off on writing this book that changed my life, which was called The Professor and the Madman. So reaching from the bath and punching in 011441865556767 is engraved on my mind. And I know that one day will come when I'll not be able to tell that story, and then I'll think, that's the beginning of the end. So it's a mixed blessing. It's nice to have a good memory, but you're aware that it's easy to lose it.
was wondering, since you mentioned the permanent El Nino, if you could talk a little bit more about that. But I also had another comment. I was in the Marshall Islands probably 10 years ago, and they were talking about developing a scuba diving and industry, and that they were telling us that they had particularly interesting fish because of the radiation. Yes. Do you know anything about
that? I do, and one of the choicest places for scuba divers, the elite, by that I mean the richest scuba divers in the world, go to Bikini, because you can, whether they see particularly interesting irradiated fish, I'm not sure, but what they're interested in doing is diving on the wrecks of the ships that were sunk by the atom bombs. And I know that when I was there, the chap with that amazing voice who does the You're in Good Hands with Allstate advertisement, I forget his name, but anyway, he was there. Yes, exactly. So it is, yeah, increasingly popular. There's not much industry. And what I should say about the Marshalls, when you went to the Marshalls, where were you? Did you go to Kwajalein? Yes. So you're aware of the situation of Ibai Island. If those of you who are not, Kwajalein is about 250 miles southwest of Bikini. And the planes that dropped the bombs on Bikini would set off from Kwajalein. Kwajalein is now the Ronald Reagan Pacific Missile Test Site. And it's full of targets and telescopes and all sorts of measuring instruments. And they fire weapons from Vandenberg here. And in fact, wasn't there something that was fired a couple of days ago that alarmed a lot of people in Los Angeles? And also from Kodiak in Alaska. And they fire towards this place. And the base is a typical U.S. Army base, you know, well-maintained lawns and mess halls and air conditioning and sports facilities and, of course, all these instruments. There are, however, 15,000 Marshallese people who live on Kwajalein, but they're not allowed to live on any of those islands. They are all crammed onto, it is actually two, but I'll only talk about one now, an island called Ibai, which is about 3 miles away from the main Kwajalein island. It's about the size of a New York City block, and 15,000 people live there. It's one of the most densely populated places on the face of the planet. They have essentially no sewage system. They have little by way of fresh water. They have appalling housing. It's a tropical slum. They don't have, for instance, it sounds trivial, but they don't have a laundromat. So when they want to wash their clothes, they have to take the ferry to Kwajalein, but are not allowed on the base, but outside the base, outside the barbed wire, the two or three washing machines that they can use, and inches away from them are Americans living a country club lifestyle that they're not permitted to enjoy. And yet these are their islands. The American government pays $17 million a year for the use of the islands. But why don't the people on Ibai see any of the benefits of that? And that goes to, well, the fact that there's an aristocracy among the Marshallese, and the island chiefs don't live on Ibai. They live in big mansions in Honolulu. So there's corruption, but the Americans do nothing to root it out, and there's a great deal of misery. And I don't know if you saw Ibai or the island up north. There's another smaller island, similarly crammed with people. The only store, its most roaring business is in Spam and potato chips and Coca-Cola. And the people, not surprisingly, the principal disease is type 2 diabetes. So it's a miserable situation.
I actually have two questions, so either one would be okay. I wonder, do you see any reality to a continuing American role maintaining freedom of the seas in the Pacific? Or do you think that's going to change? My other question is, could you tell us something about what do geographers mean when they talk about the birth of the Pacific Ocean?
Well,
take your pick.
The birth of the Pacific Ocean is a simple tectonic fact. I mean, we know when and how it opened up. I don't have the figure immediately in front of it. It's the oldest of the world's oceans. It's the relic of the great ocean that surrounded, you know, it's Pan Thalassa, which surrounded Pangaea. It's unlike the Atlantic Ocean is much more recent. So if the Atlantic is, let's say, 275 million years old, the Pacific is more like 750 million years old. So it's old, and it's, as I say, the original world ocean. Is there a reality to the idea that the Americans continue to maintain freedom of the seas? I don't see that in the Pacific they're in any way threatened by the Chinese presence. I think I would like to see, I mean, both the Chinese and the Americans have got enormous amount of self-interest in keeping the trade lanes open. I mean, the Chinese want every bit of oil and every bit of coal and every bit of bauxite and everything they can possibly import, and they want to ship their goods out to San Francisco and Long Beach and Melbourne. So they want the sea lanes open and untrammeled. And I see the rise of the Chinese naval presence in the Pacific as being absolutely no threat at all, and that the United States and China can share the responsibilities of those who might wish to interrupt free trade. And who might those people be? Well, at the moment, we don't know. I mean, North Korea, who knows? All sorts of crazy people. But I do not see them at loggerheads about this. I mean, maybe I'm being naive, but I don't see the Chinese. They have wounded pride for all sorts of good reasons, and they have some hegemonistic ambitions, but not territorial seizure and not inhibition of trade. Everyone wants free trade. Although, of course, the Americans do not at the moment want China to be part of the TPP, you know, the new trade deal, because the Chinese will take a very long time to bring their places of production up to the same labor standards that are enjoyed by the signatories of the TPP. But I think that's another mistake. I think China's got to be brought into this embrace as well. You cannot ignore China. The world is changing very rapidly, and China is a hugely important component. And we must stop fearing China. We must work with the Chinese, I think, and the Pacific is the obvious place to do it. Well, join me in thanking Simon Winchester.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.